Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ivan Sarkissian. My registration number is 28817, and I represent the appellant, the Rust T. Diamonds Company. My client is a specialty contractor that, to borrow the appellee's description of it, performs work as an expert concrete cutter. Rust T. Diamonds was hired by BSLNI to saw cut concrete off of a bridge that spanned over the Roaring Fork River in Carbondale. And this was a pretty interesting project because the bridge, which was concrete, which was supported by steel girders and other steel members, actually spanned over a trout fishing spot that had to be protected. And so this project had the unique characteristic to it of not allowing the concrete construction process to just jackhammer out the concrete. The concrete had to be carefully cut out so that the concrete could be removed in complete 6-foot panels and minimize the amount of concrete that would fall into the river. Anytime the concrete would fall into the river, there was an issue with how the cleanup needed to take place because of the environmentally sensitive nature of the area. So in order to complete this, my client was called in as the expert specialty contractor. And to give you a little bit of background on the work that they were doing, this concrete slab had two sets of reinforcing rebar, metal mats that were installed as part of the concrete construction process. The bottom of the two mats was basically flush with the steel of the bridge itself. And so in order to get the concrete out, my client was called in to saw through the concrete, including going through the rebar, and going through the rebar cleanly enough so that the concrete could be removed intact and not allow any concrete to fall into the river. Both my client and BSLNI, and I think the record's undisputed on this, understood that when my client was going to perform the cutting operations, that the saw blades that were going to be used were going to have to come into contact with the steel members of the bridge. There was no dispute about that. You couldn't get through the rebar and the concrete that was basically adjacent to the steel of the bridge without going through part of the bridge. That was part of the job, and it was understood, and again, the record, I think, is undisputed on that. As the concrete panels were removed, and BSLNI observed damage to the bridge, it said, that's too much damage. And it sued Rust T. Diamonds, claiming that Rust T. Diamonds should be responsible for fixing the bridge. When the case was filed in May of 2010, there was only one claim pled, and that was for negligence. The case moved along until roughly 10 days before trial, and a trial brief was filed, and the issue of the economic loss rule was raised. The economic loss rule, as you know, you've read the briefs, say that where you have two commercial parties entering into a contract and the damage is purely economic loss, no negligence claim can exist. It can't have a negligence claim. All you can have is a contract claim. That brief was filed. BSLNI contested that. They filed their own sort of responsive trial brief saying, we don't think that's true. We think we can go forward with our negligence claim. The day before the trial court decided, no, that's not the case, and said, I'm going to dismiss the negligence claim, and vacated the trial date based on that, allowing the plaintiff to replead a new cause of action based on the contract which should have been pled at the beginning of the case.
So when the motion to dismiss was filed, Rust T. Diamonds had filed its answer, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And Rule 12B makes very clear, doesn't it, that a motion to be filed under that subsection must be filed before a responsive pleading is filed.
I think that is the language of Rule 12B.
And the statute says that it must, that the fees will be awarded when there is a dismissal under Rule 12B, right?
That is correct.
And so, and there's no, I mean, is there an argued ambiguity with regard to either the statute or the rule?
I think with respect to the rule, I think you have to read 12B in conjunction with 12H, which 12B, as you know, affords different areas where you can seek to have a case dismissed, including failure to state a claim. Rule 12H2 then basically drags out, for lack of a better term, the process by which a failure to state a claim defense can be raised under 12B.
Now, 12H says you can file a motion for judgment on the pleadings, as I understand it, and Rule 12C provides for a motion for judgment on the pleadings, right?
I think Rule 12H says that you can raise a failure to state a claim argument as a motion for judgment on the pleadings, or in accordance with Rule 7.
Or in a pleading in accordance with Rule 7?
Yes.
Or at trial?
Or at trial, correct.
So it would be your position, therefore, that if the case is dismissed under the economic loss rule in the middle of trial, that's a 12B5 motion to which you're entitled to legal fees?
My position is, in this case, what happened was the 12B5 motion was filed. The timeliness argument that you're raising certainly was raised by the plaintiff.
I'm not raising a timeliness argument, I don't think.
The timing of the motion.
Okay.
Under the exact argument that you're making was raised by the plaintiff. And the court rejected it. It basically said the court was going to accept the 12B5 motion as a 12B5 motion. But even though it was filed on the eve of trial, and then the court granted relief explicitly under 12B5. And therefore, if you get into 1317201, it says if you prevail on a 12B motion.
Counsel, how could it be a 12B motion? Excuse me, counsel. How could it be a 12B motion when you had already filed your answer? It automatically, under the plain language of the rule, is not a 12B motion anymore.
I
understand the trial court ruled the way you're saying it did, but I'm asking you now to tell us why we should ignore the plain language of Rule 12B under these circumstances.
Like I said, I think 12H opens the door to raising failure to state a claim motions after the time period allowed under Rule 12B5.
I don't disagree with that, but I don't think it opens the door to filing a Rule 12B motion later. I don't see any language. Is there language in 12H that provides that a 12B motion may be filed?
It's because 12B5 refers to failure to state a claim. The language in 12H specifically talks about raising a failure to state a claim defense even after the 12B period as set forth in that rule. So, 1317, the court in any event granted the 12B5 motion and did so explicitly, saying it was granting the relief under 12B5. Under that, based on that order, the award of attorney fees was non-discretionary. It was mandatory. Nevertheless, the court decided to not grant the award of attorney fees, and we contend that decision was an error. I think the Crandall case is, right on point. It's a Colorado Supreme Court case, and it described 1372.01 as an unequivocal mandate for an award of attorney fees to a defendant when it prevails pretrial on a 12B motion. And the statute applies to all tort actions without exception. And the concept behind this statute is to act as a deterrent, to keep plaintiffs from filing negligence claims or tort-based claims when they should not be filed. It's not a remedial statute. The idea is to say, if you're going to file a negligence or a tort-based claim, you better make sure that you've got a good legal basis to do that. And here they didn't. That's undisputed. I mean, the basic argument is there can't be a negligence claim, and that's why when it was raised in the trial brief, the plaintiff had a number of options. The plaintiff could have elected to stipulate to the dismissal of the negligence claim, could have sought leave immediately to amend its pleadings and bring a contract action, but instead it chose to fight about it. Instead it chose to contest the fact that the negligence claim should be argued, and again the court found that as a matter of law under the 12B5 standards that no negligence claim could proceed, and vacated the trial date as a result of that fight. There's the case that I think is also instructive on this. This is the Sotelo case from the Colorado Court of Appeals. The first issue I have with the Sotelo case, which I assume they're going to rely on, is it predates the Crandall decision, and I think with the unequivocal and frankly, very direct language from the Colorado Supreme Court, I'm not sure that the, what I look at as an exception set forth in the Sotelo case is even going to make it past. In any event, I want to keep moving here. The Sotelo case facts are significantly different. In Sotelo, the plaintiff had pled three causes of action in the initial pleading, two of which were dismissed and the case proceeded on the only contract claim. Again, here, the only cause of action that was pled at the outset of the case was negligence. That was the claim that was dismissed by the trial court, prompting the motion for attorney fees. I want to get to the other part of our brief, which relates to the discretion issue and whether the court failed to require the plaintiff as part of its prima facie case to set forth or to provide an expert in order to establish standards for its prima facie case. I think it's important to note that even BSL&I acknowledged in their briefs, the trial brief in particular, it's at the record 3955899 at page 4, the expertise required to perform this work. Expertise which frankly falls outside the common knowledge or experience of laypersons. When you have that situation, the only time you can dispense with the need for expert testimony is when the misstep is so palpable or egregious that adding expert testimony would be superfluous. And I think the best example of this is the one that's often cited is a situation where a physician has cut off the wrong leg in an amputation procedure. And honestly, I think it's fair to say that that's a pretty easy to understand mistake that would require expert testimony. But I think that example really highlights the problem that we have in this case. In this case, we don't have a situation where the wrong leg was cut off. In this case, we have an allegation that we should have cut maybe a little bit lower, or maybe we should have cut a different part of the leg. But all of these things become much more complicated, a much more complicated set of analysis that has to be done that compels the need to have an expert to come in and understand what, as a concrete cutter, they should have done or could have done when faced with rebar flush against a concrete bridge. Again, this is a situation not where BSL&I believed that the bridge shouldn't have been cut at all. They knew it was going to be cut. They just didn't like how much it was cut after the fact.
Counsel, my understanding is there was evidence that that there was an agreement that any damage would be only minor damage.
That's correct. I think that's
and there was expert testimony, was there not, that the damage was more than minor?
I think if you're referring to the engineer from the Colorado Department of Transportation, I think that he did testify that he was concerned about the amount of damage to the bridge. Yes, I think that's the whole point. It's not that there was more damage than there was damage that needed to be repaired. I think the issue is what constituted minor damage in the context of this case.
And did you object to that expert's testimony regarding what's minor damage?
I believe that in terms of whether it was minor, it was not an issue that was objected to. I think the issue was...
Did you object to his qualification as an expert?
No. I wouldn't try to counsel.
I'm sorry. I'm
objecting to your hearing. At the trial court, at the trial on it. I don't think that there was an objection made to his qualifications as an engineer, and I think the court accepted him as an engineer. I think his testimony was focused on whether the bridge had to be fixed, which, of course, it had to be fixed. The issue isn't whether the bridge had to be fixed. The issue is whether the bridge having to be fixed was as a result of Rusty Diamonds doing something that it shouldn't have based on its contract. And that's the whole point, is that in this context, there's no way for the jury to comprehend and understand whether you could have had minor or major damage. I think of, you know, the example I was trying to use in my head is the pilot we took off from New York City and hit birds and ended up having to land in the water. And I think anyone can understand, well, why on earth would a pilot have to land the plane in the water as opposed to landing the plane on a runway at an airport the way any other pilot would? And to me, that really says it all for our case here, is that you have to understand what happened, and you have to have somebody explain that what the pilot was going through in order to understand why the decision was made that ended up being made. I'm going to reserve the last 10 seconds of my time. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. May it please the board. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Chief Schoenberger, registration number 41922, and I'm here on behalf of BSLNI, the plaintiff and the appellee in this case. If Your Honors would like me to address any particular point first, I'm happy to do that. Otherwise, I'd like to start with the fees statute issue and then move on to the expert testimony. Your Honors, when we put the fees issue in a proper context, we see how really counterintuitive it is. Diamonds said nothing for a year, waited till the eve of trial to seek a dismissal. The motion at that point really only changed the legal theory from negligence to contract because of the economic loss rule. No new discovery was required. The case still went to trial on the same facts, and they lost. Now they want my client, the prevailing party, who prevailed on the merits at trial, to pay a substantial portion of their legal fees. Now, there's a reason no court has ever applied the fee statute in that situation. And that's because the legislature never intended, after a trial on the merits, for the prevailing party to have to pay the defendants, the losing parties, legal fees. And we know that, as Your Honor pointed out, from the statute itself. The statute has two very clear conditions. The entire action, the plaintiff's entire action, has to be dismissed, and it has to be dismissed under Rule 12B. Now, why is Rule 12B important? Because the legislature put it directly in the statute and thereby incorporated the provisions of that rule, including the timing requirements. So it's clear that Diamonds filed its motion on the eve of trial under a different rule, and that rule is 12H, and that, as on the face of the statute, does not apply, or does not trigger the statute, I should say.
Why is it a 12H motion and not, as Judge Miller suggested earlier, a 12C motion? No matter what they called it, an answer had been filed. Why isn't it a motion for judgment on the pleadings under 12C?
Well, I'm not sure that it's not, but it's definitely not a motion under Rule 12B. We know that. And I would encourage the court to look at the credit theft case, which was cited by Diamonds in the reply brief for the first time. I didn't have a chance to brief it, so I'm going to talk about it quickly now. The facts of that case are really not the same facts we have here, but what's interesting...
What's the name of the case again?
Credit theft was the defendant. I think it's Colorado Resources or something like that is the plan. And the interesting thing about that case is that the defendant filed a motion in limine just before trial and said all the evidence has to be barred because this is a land sale deal and the plaintiff's allegations of fraud in the inducement of the sale all merged into the warranty deed, and therefore they can't present any evidence of pre-contract negotiations and so forth. Different situation. But what's interesting is the defendant, after filing the motion in limine, asked the court to convert it into a motion to dismiss, which is effectively is what we have here, a motion to dismiss at or immediately before trial. And the court granted it, and then on appeal, the plaintiffs came in and said, oh, this was untimely, it was unfair, we weren't given a chance to respond. And the Court of Appeals said, no, it was timely under Rule H2. And that's exactly my argument. They filed a motion under Rule H2. Rule 12B, barred them on the face of that statute. And therefore, the fees statute does not get triggered. Now, there's no... Just because a lawyer calls his motion a 12B5 motion doesn't transform it into one. There's nothing magical
about calling the motion a 12B5. You have to look at the arguments and the substance of the motion. And when we look at Darwin's motion, the first argument they make is that Rule 12H2 allows us to do this. And again, it's clear that that does not trigger the statute under the plain language of the statute. And I'll talk about one other case that was cited in the reply brief for the first time, and that's Crow. And they rely on Crow for the one sentence in Crow says, and that, by the way, that's a 2011 decision from a different division of this court, so it's fairly recent. But the sentence in that case said, the fee statute applies to any dismissal under Rule 12. But I think it's fairly obvious that the division just misspoke there. Certainly, it didn't intend to disregard the plain language of the statute, because that would violate the rules of construction. And if you look at the facts, the issue in that case was whether the fee statute applies to 12B5 or whether it applies to the other four subsections of 12B. And the court cited a bunch of cases and said, look, it's been applied in all these other 12B cases. And that's how it addressed that argument. So the actual analysis and holding of that case is consistent with the statute, even if the wording of that one sentence was a little off.
Counsel, I read that cited by, I didn't see that sentence. I did see a sentence that said it's not limited to Rule 12B5, and then it cites a series of cases for involving dismissals under Rule 12B1, you know, for there is a sentence, maybe it's on another page, that he didn't cite that would.
I'm not sure if his citation was correct, but there is a sentence in there, you know, I'll admit, that says, okay, under the auspices of any provision of Rule 12. It ends at 12, it omitted B, which I claim is clearly an error. So the second condition of the fee statute is that the plaintiff's entire action has to be dismissed. And Diamonds concedes in its reply brief, pages 3 to 4, that action, the term action, is not synonymous with claim, and that action means the entire legal proceedings before the court. Frankly, with that concession, I'm not sure where Diamonds goes from there, because it's clear that the proceedings were not dismissed. The court continued to manage the case, it continued to enter orders, it kept the trial date, it ordered my client to amend its complaint within 5 days, Diamonds to answer and amend its complaint within 5 days after that. And in the interim, it granted and denied various motions in limine. So clearly, the legal proceedings were ongoing.
Saying how it kept the trial date, several times the briefs say that the motion was filed on the evening before the trial.
I'm sorry. Yes. When the motion was filed, the court vacated the May, I think, 31st trial date or somewhere around there, within a day or two of the motion being filed. And then it reset the trial for July 11th. Those are in the minute orders. And it also scheduled a pretrial conference on July 7th. Those dates never were vacated. And then a couple of weeks later, the judge ruled on the motion simultaneously in the same order, granted leave to amend. The parties did that. The court continued to rule on in limine motions, and we went to trial. The other thing that's problematic for Diamond's position on that point is that the statute is designed to prevent unnecessary litigation. And that didn't happen. What I mean by that is, let's assume that Diamond filed its motion right out of the gate, and we got the same order. Negligence dismissed, leave to amend, had the contract. Parties still litigated for a year. It still goes to trial. Diamond still loses. So there's no prevention of litigation. BSL and I had a valid claim all along. It just pled it under the wrong theory, and that was corrected, and we were on our way. So I'm going to move on to the last issue, which is the expert testimony. And you know, frankly, this whole business about needing expert testimony, I think, is a red herring and a misdirection, frankly, because Diamonds is applying it in the wrong context. That's typically the standard of, or the standard of duty of care, I guess, how we describe it in a negligence case. But this is not a negligence case anymore. It's a contract case. And so my client only had to prove that Diamonds breached a term of the contract, and that's what they did. They submitted evidence that Diamonds promised that they were going to cut the deck, cut the concrete, without causing more than minor damage to the underlying girders. There was also testimony that minor damage means nothing more than a nicker scrape of 1/16 of an inch deep, and there was extra testimony from the engineer that the damage was far worse than that, cutting entirely through the girders and the planks in some spots. So I think what Diamonds is really looking for here is a license to breach the contract. They want to be able to say, yeah, we understand what we promised you, BSL and I, but forget about that, because we adhere to our industry standards, and if that means your girders get destroyed, so be it. We're not liable for that, because we adhered to some standard, despite the fact that we promised you something else. That's never been the law of contract in this state or in any other jurisdiction that I know of.
So in that respect, when you were talking earlier about the dismissal issue, you said, well, the trial was the same as it would have been in a negligence case. That's not quite right, is it? Because if it was a negligence case, you would have had to put on standard of review expert testimony.
Well, that's true. That's a little bit of a tricky question, because we would also contend that given the conditions of retaining Diamonds, that when they're not to cut the girders and they cut the girders, that is an obvious error on their part that doesn't require any expert testimony. There's nothing scientific about don't cut the girders, oops, I cut the girders.
You didn't have to make that argument.
We didn't have to make that argument on a contract theory, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so under the directed verdict standard, which is one of the rulings that's being appealed here, the court was required to view all the evidence in the light most favorable to my client, and to deny that motion if there's any evidence that reasonably supports a verdict. And so under that standard, the court correctly viewed these promises and breaches in the light most favorable to my client and allowed it to go to the jury. And then the jury came back and said, yes, you breached the contract. You breached the term of the contract. And also important is that the jury rejected their affirmative defenses of estoppel and inducement. And so then we get to the JNOV, and it's important to note that Diamonds never challenged the jury's findings or verdict in any way. They never said it was against the manifest weight of the evidence. They never said it was contrary to the facts or contrary to the law. They never said it was inconsistent. They never said it was contrary to the instructions. All they did was rehash the same expert testimony argument. Well, I think logic dictates that if the evidence was sufficient to reasonably support a verdict in my client's favor before the verdict, and then that verdict happened, then the same evidence supports it after the fact. The only difference in that standard is that you're looking prospectively versus retrospectively. So the court correctly denied the JNOV on the fact that there was evidence of a breach, and the jury found, according to its verdict form, that there was a breach and that our client was entitled to the money. So unless the court has any questions, we'd ask that it affirm the trial court's rulings, and I'll end on that note.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenberg. See what you can do in 10 seconds.
I'll do my best. One point which counsel made, which I didn't quite track because it's actually contrary to what they said in the brief, and is it doesn't matter that it's a contract claim, that there still can be the need for expert testimony, even in the context of a contract claim. That's the Martinez versus Battis case, which both parties cite. Martinez said that a contract claim may or may not require expert testimony to establish the elements thereof. It just depends on the facts of the contract and the duties that are alleged to have been breached.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted. Division will issue an opinion in due course.